Hi, this is Steve Nerlich.
Why cheap astronomy?
Yeah, why? And this is Dear Cheap Astronomy, episode 147, Impact. Making an impact with a 10-minute podcast isn't easy. Just look at our Patreon donations, which are all made by absolutely lovely people, just not all that many of them. Nonetheless, impact comes in many forms. For example, Dear Cheap Astronomy, how far does the effect of solar flares extend? So, firstly, the strict definition of a solar flare is a flash of light associated with the rapid acceleration of charged particles. After all, light is electromagnetic radiation, so it's not surprising to get such flashes associated with all the dynamic electromagnetic activity of the sun. Although perhaps it's best to say that solar flare events are associated with electromagnetic uproars to distinguish flare events from the general broiling activity that goes on in the sun. A solar flare is a very energetic event, releasing not only visible light, but also shorter wavelength, higher energy, ultraviolet and X-rays. Such high energy radiation will affect planetary atmospheres, including Earth's, where the UV and X-rays will ionize gases in the so-called ionosphere, which has an effect on shortwave radio transmission. Of course, there's more to this story than just problems with shortwave radio. Most people tend to associate solar flares with everything else that happens during a solar electromagnetic outburst, such as a coronal mass ejection or smaller-scale solar particle events. These are what cause most of the trouble commonly associated with solar flares. Their effects range from the aurora we can see around both of Earth's poles, as well as inducing currents within terrestrial wire networks, which could short out entire power grids. And higher up there is also the potential to disrupt satellite operations. It's also the case that actual solar flares can be a problem for satellites by heating up Earth's atmosphere so it expands, thereby creating drag and hence degrading the orbits of satellites, particularly low Earth orbiting ones. But the effect of solar flares and solar particle outbursts extend well past Earth's orbit. On Mars, our rovers have detected solar flares and Martian auroras arising from them. Jupiter can get X-ray auroras from them, as does Mercury for that matter, though there is some different physics involved. Uranus gets some weird wobbles in its already weird magnetosphere, remembering that Uranus is tilted over and rotates on its side, with one or more of its poles directly facing the Sun for much of its orbit. Then there's Neptune, which is known to develop more of its wispy white clouds just after solar maxima, which is when solar flares are most frequent. Whether the higher frequency of Neptunian clouds is due to heating from solar flares or electromagnetic disturbances from solar particle flux is yet to be determined. The effect of solar flares continues past the planets, indeed right out to the heliopause, the boundary at which the sun's output of solar wind is countered by the pressure of the interstellar wind, that is, the general background of photons and charged particles that exists between stellar systems. Again, solar flares, the bursts of electromagnetic radiation, don't have much effect on the heliopause themselves. But coronal mass ejections sure do. After all, these are fast-moving particles with both mass and charge, so they essentially represent a large gust against the normal background of solar wind. Such large gusts push the heliopause further outwards, distorting its general shape,
But that is then the end of those solar particles' journey. The large gust of particles doesn't get through the heliopause, it just pushes it outwards. What does get through, though, is the actual solar flare, the burst of electromagnetic radiation that's brighter than the normal radiation output of the sun. With the right technology, aliens from across the galaxy should be able to see the light from our sun and also the faint flashes of flares. After all, we can readily see flares from other stars with the right equipment. So, we can say the effect of solar flares is essentially infinite. Intergalactic aliens might struggle to distinguish the light of our star from the general glow of the billions of other stars in the Milky Way, but the light of our sun and its flares will be part of it.
This is the middle bit.
So, solar flares impact the entire solar system, are detectable across most of the galaxy, and even in some neighbouring galaxies. Not too shabby. But now, let's talk about some potential impacts much closer to home. Dear cheap astronomy, how stupid is it to deliberately crash asteroids on the moon? If you ask an AI search engine about crashing asteroids on the moon as a new approach to asteroid mining, it will tell you it's a stupid idea, as would a lot of humans. Such a deliberate impact is going to throw up ejecta, which could exceed the escape velocity of the moon and hence become a risk to Earth, or that ejecta could go into orbit around the moon, becoming a risk to spacecraft wanting to land, or it might just throw up ejecta that will fall back down onto a growing lunar colony. Clearly, the whole idea is just daft. If you ask an AI search engine how many people have died on Earth from tailing dam collapses, it will tell you that between 1961 and 2019, an estimated 2,375 people died over that nearly 60-year period. So that's some measure of the accepted risk of mining on Earth. If you ask an AI search engine if mining on Earth is stupid, it will tell you that, well, it's environmentally destructive, but that's probably necessary to power a sustainable future. You've got to break some eggs to make an omelette. It's not clear how big an asteroid would have to be to throw up ejecta from a lunar collision with enough force to achieve escape velocity, since it somewhat depends upon the speed and composition of the asteroid and its angle of approach. A colliding object 1 kilometre in diameter will absolutely produce escape velocity ejecta, but it's also possible with smaller ones under the right conditions. There are meteorites on Earth that clearly have come from the Moon, about 300 documented ones, though it's thought they may only be the result of around 30 lunar impact events, since some are clearly bits of the same rock. Most of these lunar meteorites are estimated to have been ejected from the Moon in the last 100,000 years, presumably because anything older than that has since been buried, eroded, or washed away. Anyhow, that is at least 20 lunar impact events sufficient to produce escape velocity ejecta in the last 100,000 years, which is one every 5,000 years on average. Most of those were almost certainly less than 1 kilometre in diameter, since we think Earth only gets hit by something that big every 500,000 years or so, and Earth is a bigger target. So if there was a deliberate program to crash asteroids on the Moon that were in the sub-1 kilometre range, sure, there is a minute risk of someone on Earth getting hit on the head by a big rock or having their house wrecked by one, but we are just talking big rocks, nothing in the mass extinction or even Tunguska range. Of course, there are the more tangible risks of putting ejecta into lunar orbit or on a parabolic trajectory to somewhere else on the lunar surface. Although, the chance of putting something on the exact trajectory and velocity needed to achieve orbit is pretty slim, it's a lot more likely the ejecta would either achieve escape velocity or fall back down.
In any case, Earth is currently surrounded by orbiting debris of our own making. Nonetheless, an increasing number of spacecraft still get through that okay. We just have to keep track of all that orbiting junk. So it would seem the main risk of deliberately crashing sub-1 kilometer asteroids on the Moon is that risk of the ejector falling back down if we do actually have a lunar colony. So then it's worth thinking why we are going to have a lunar colony in the first place. Are we seriously just going to mine what's there now? Because there isn't that much there now. Are we seriously just going to do science? That might be possible to the extent that a lot of countries have bases in Antarctica that do science, though perhaps they're partly there because other countries have bases there. So we're all keeping an eye on each other to see if anyone can figure out something lucrative to do there. And that is the trick with the Moon. We have to figure out something lucrative to do there. So if we are planning on mining asteroids anyway, why not crash them on the Moon and make it our great orbiting quarry in the sky? Of course, we'd have to establish any lunar colonies deep underground, out of harm's way, but that's probably what we're going to do anyway because of the radiation and the existing micrometeorite risk. So, is it stupid to deliberately crash asteroids on the Moon? Maybe, but just how stupid are all the other ideas we have at the moment? Go ask an AI search engine.
This is the end bit.
So, there you go. Impacts are what you make of them, although you also need to consider that what you make can have an impact. But that's it for another episode of Dear Cheap Astronomy. If you've got a space science question, or you just want to make a dent in something, why not write to cheapastro@gmail.com and we'll patch it up for you. Thanks for listening. Steve Nerlich, Cheap Astronomy.